We ended our last lecture talking about the difference between higher quality pleasures and lower quality pleasures, and of course in the broader scheme of things we were contrasting qualitative hedonism with quantitative hedonism. Of course, qualitative hedonism being John Stuart Mill's theory, quantitative hedonism being Jeremy Bentham's theory. I want to continue with that discussion in a slightly different way. Rather than contrasting qualitative and quantitative hedonism, I want now to just simply focus on the idea that pleasure is really all that matters, which of course is what hedonism provides us with, right? Hedonists believe that if I'm living the right kind of life, or sorry, not the right kind of life, but the life with the most quality, the life that's truly valuable, the most valuable life will be a life filled with pleasure and the least amount of pain. Right? It's about maximizing instances of pleasure, minimizing instances of pain. And so, if pleasure is all that matters, one question that might naturally arise is whether or not what I don't know will hurt me, right? If pleasure is all that matters, another way of stating the question is, if pleasure is all that matters, then why won't it be okay? Why won't it be all right just to get pleasurable internal experiences, right? And what I mean by this is, hedonism ultimately is what we call a mental states theory of well-being. And we'll contrast hedonism with another view called preference theory in a few minutes. For the time being, I want to introduce two examples to help you see why hedonism might be a problem. The first example normally isn't enough to help you see just why hedonism is a problem, but with the combination of both the second or first and second examples, you'll be able to see just why hedonism may be a problem for us. So again, if pleasure is all that matters, then it seems that what I don't know won't hurt me. So here, example number one. Imagine a successful businessman. He is the owner of a very successful company. He has business partners who admire him. He is married. He has a beautiful wife. They've been married for over two decades. He has children that love and admire him. And unfortunately, this man gets hit by a bus and dies. But he dies, of course, without knowing that in actuality, his business partners have been embezzling funds from the company for a number of years. And shortly after his death, the company goes under. He dies without knowing that in actuality, his wife has been having a 10-year love affair with a close friend of his. He dies without knowing that his children can't really stand to be around him. They use him for money. He dies without knowing all of this. The question is, has this person lived a good life? Now, I want you to suspend any kind of moral judgments you might have about, you might think immediately, what's wrong with this guy? Why can't he tell that this is going on? How did the people pull the wool over his eyes for so long? And those are natural questions to want to ask, but I want you to suspend them for the time being and just reflect upon whether or not this person has lived a good life, whether or not he's had more pleasure than pain in his life. And most of my students admit that if that's the question, then the answer must be yes, that this man has had more pleasure in his life than pain. He's lived a good life. And I suspect that most of you also agree with that. Every once in a while, I'll get a student who actually thinks the businessman lived not so good a life, for whatever reason. And of course, that's a different question. We could ask this question: had he known about all of these various things that were going on in his life, would he then have been happy? And of course, the answer is probably no, he would not have been happy, right? But of course, not knowing those things the suggestion seems to be that, yeah, it's possible to live a valuable life under those conditions. All right, second example then. Imagine that scientists have developed a new technology. They call it the experience machine. And in the experience machine, they promise that with the experience machine, they can provide you with the best kind of life, with a life filled with more pleasure than pain. What they promised is that you can get into this tank, and they'll hook up electrodes to your body, to your brain, ultimately, right? And beforehand, you'll tell them the kind of life that you want to live, right? If you want to be the quarterback in the Super Bowl, there you are in the Super Bowl, right? We just put in the tape and there you are. If you want to write the great American novel, there you are, writing the great American novel, right? Just a different tape, right? We program the computer to give you the kind of life that you want. If you want to climb Mount Everest, right? There you are, climbing Mount Everest and having the kind of life that you think is truly valuable. So the question is, will you get in the tank? Now, students invariably have questions about, getting in the tank. Can I get out once I get in? And of course, here the answer is no, right? You're trading the life you have for life in the tank. But there's really no way of distinguishing between the life you have now and the life that you would have in the tank, right? One way to sort of conceptualize this is to imagine that you're in the tank right now. How would you know the difference? And here I have something in mind, something very much like The Matrix in mind, right? And maybe you've seen that film, maybe not, but the idea is that, in the tank, your life is artificial, right? Of course, you don't know that. There's no indication from inside the tank that there's something wrong, right? It's only from outside the tank that you know there's something wrong with it. But once you get in, there's really no way of distinguishing the life that you would have inside the tank from the life you would have outside of it. Students also ask questions about, if my life is filled with only pleasure, then, it's the painful experiences that are so instrumental in changing my life, right? It's, when my boyfriend breaks up with me or when my girlfriend breaks up with me, those types of experiences shape us in many ways, right? Negative experiences often change us far more than positive ones do, and I wouldn't dispute that. Although, all I would say is that, inside the tank, if you want to have some painful experiences, we'll program those in too, right? So it's not that your life will be only pleasure. If you think having at least some pain in my life is important to living the best kind of life, then we'll program that in as well. So as I say, there really is no way to distinguish between the life that's available outside the tank from the life that's available inside the tank. The only distinction is this, that if you get into the tank, we'll guarantee that on the whole your life will be more pleasurable than painful. And of course, outside the tank, you really don't have that kind of guarantee. Things could turn ill for you outside the tank, right? Your life could become a complete failure. And inside the tank, that's not possible. Right? We'll arrange things such that we guarantee you that you'll have a more pleasurable life than painful. Okay, so the question is, will you get in the tank? And almost without fail, hardly anyone ever wants to get in the tank. I usually have, in a class of 30, I'll have maybe one or two or perhaps even three students want to get into the tank. And I suspect that's true for you as well. Most of you think there's something missing from life in the tank. Others of you, very few of you, I imagine, will think, yeah, I'd get into the tank. Now, it's important here as well, just as I asked you to suspend your moral intuitions, when you are thinking about the businessman, I want you to do the same here. Right? The question isn't, is it moral to get into the tank? No, that's not the question at all. The question now becomes, Does the tank provide me with the best kind of life? And in this case, we're asking, is life in the tank more pleasurable than painful? And, of course, the answer seems to be, yeah, life in the tank is more pleasurable than painful. But yet, that being said, very few of us want to get into the tank. Most of us think there's something wrong with life in the tank. All right, so what does this mean? Well, two things. If you thought that the business person lived a good life, and yet you're not willing to get into the tank, there seems to be some kind of inconsistency involved there, right? On the one hand, we could say, look, you agree that the business person lived a good life, even though he was radically deceived about his life. Yet you don't want to get into the tank, right? Now, there are obvious differences between, you know, the two cases as they were presented. We could point to, you know, the choice of getting into the tank, right? On the one hand, I'm making a choice to get into the tank. The business person didn't choose to have his wife cheat on him, and that's all true. The way that those two examples are similar, however, is this, right? Both individuals, the person who gets into the tank and the business person, are radically deceived about their environment, are radically deceived about the quality of their life. Right? They believe their lives are of a high quality, yet they're not really of a high quality. Right? So it's interesting to think about, you know, what is motivating us to believe that the business person lived a good life, and at the same time to think about, you know, why it is that we don't want to get into the tank. All right, so let's see. If you're the kind of person who doesn't want to get into the tank, most likely the reason is that you're not entirely convinced that pleasure is all that matters in life. Right? If pleasure were all that mattered, most likely you'd be willing to get into the tank. You'd be willing to have a more pleasurable life, and of course the tank guarantees that you will. But you care about something else, you know, whatever it might be, and it's hard to articulate just what it is that we care about if we're not willing to get into the tank, since life in the tank is indistinguishable from life in the real world. Right? So, some theorists have preferred to think about something other than pleasure, and there is something called the preference theory of well-being, which says, ultimately, that well-being is about actually getting what you want. Right? And here, what we want to say is that things are desirable because we want them. So the preference theory is ultimately just about getting what we want. And we contrast it with the mental states theory of well-being that was central to thinking in the 19th century. Preference theory becomes very popular in the 20th century, and ultimately, preference theory is really just about satisfying our preferences, right? And so, what is truly valuable in life? Well, getting what I want. That's what's valuable, right? Now, of course, we wouldn't want to say that I have to have everything that I want in order to live a good life, but I've got to get enough of what I want to be satisfied, right? So preference theory really is about satisfying my rational preferences. And and I guess that's really all to be said there. I won't spend a lot of time talking about preference theory, but just know this, that preference theory is an alternative to hedonism, and both are accounts of what it means to live the good life. Right? Okay. Let's see. How are we going to move forward? Well, I'm going to shift gears, I guess. We need to talk now. We're still talking about theories of the good, right? But we need to talk now, making a shift from hedonism and preference theory, we need to now talk about how to aggregate well-being, right? And we need to talk about a view called welfarism. Now, there are two ways of becoming a welfarist, right? We can become welfarists by becoming hedonists, right? So We become hedonists. That automatically makes us a welfarist, right? What we're concerned with is the well-being of individuals. But we can also become welfarists by becoming preference theorists, right? So by adopting preference theory, I become a welfarist. By adopting hedonism, I become a welfarist, right? And in both cases, what I'm concerned with is the well-being of individuals, right? Whether it's about maximizing pleasure in the cases that we've examined, or whether it's about satisfying the preferences that that we encounter in individuals, in both cases, we're concerned with maximizing well-being, right? And so one of the questions that we have to deal with is, how do we aggregate well-being? Now, to aggregate is to take account of the totality of a given experience, right? And it's about issues of distribution, and is it possible to distribute well-being, and how would you go about doing that, right? All right, so now, for the purposes of aggregation, we're going to imagine this case, right? Imagine that we have John on the one hand and Lisa on the other, and John has a migraine. He's experiencing a negative 20 unit deficiency in well-being, right? Lisa has a hangnail, and she's at -5, okay? Now, we're going to give the aspirin, we have one aspirin, and we're going to give it to either John or Lisa. If we give it to John, we can bring John up to a 0, okay? Meaning that he'll experience an overall improvement of 20 units, right? We bring him from negative 20 up to 0. He's experienced a 20 unit gain in well-being. If we give the aspirin to Lisa, we can bring her up to a positive 1, right? Moving from -5 to positive 1, she experiences a net gain of 6 units of well-being. So we add things up, and whatever outcome leads to the best or to the greatest well-being overall is the best outcome. Right? So let me ask you, who do we give the aspirin to? Do we give it to John or do we give it to Lisa? Well, some of you might think we should give it to Lisa because we're moving Lisa not to 0 but to a positive net gain. Right? She's at a +1. John's at 0. Ultimately, what the welfarist will claim is that we should give it to John. And the reason for that is because total well-being is the only thing that matters toward the goodness of an outcome. Okay? Ultimately, what they care about is the gain. How much are we improving the welfare of the individual under consideration? In this case, we've improved John's situation by 20 units. We've only improved Lisa's situation by 6. So, in terms of who gets the aspirin, the welfarist is going to recommend that we give it to John because we can do more good there, okay? Now, the thing that we have to talk about is something called the problem of interpersonal comparisons. What is the problem of interpersonal comparisons? Well, as you've seen, in dealing with the case that we just looked at, John and Lisa, the implication is that when I consider John's situation over against Lisa's situation, the implication is that I understand, in some sense, what it means for Lisa to have a hangnail, right? And also that I understand what it means for John to have a migraine, right? And some theorists have been worried that these kinds of comparisons, comparing Lisa's pain to John's pain, or comparing John's pain to my own pain, or Lisa's pain to my own pain, these kinds of comparisons are actually invalid. Some theorists are skeptical of the comparison and go as far as saying that such comparisons are meaningless. Now, whether or not these comparisons are meaningless really will depend on how confident we are that we can really diagnose the amount of pain that another human being is experiencing. So let's think of a few concrete examples. Imagine that I stub my toe on the way to the bathroom in the middle of the night, and I tell you about the story the next day. So I tell you, and I stub my toe, and after hearing the story, you confess that you had a similar experience a month ago. And you begin to commiserate with me. Right? And we talk about how painful it was. Is it possible that we know enough about each other's situation that we can properly diagnose just how much pain we under, you know, that we experienced? That's what we want to know. Right? Can I make meaningful comparisons across persons? Right? Well, in a case like that, it seems, you know, that we can say something meaningful about, you know, the pain that a stubbed toe would cause. But there may be other cases where it would be far more difficult, especially if I haven't experienced the pain that you're suffering. For example, imagine that you lost your father to cancer. Well, I haven't lost my father to cancer. So is it possible for me to imagine what it might be like for you to lose your father to cancer? Well, even here, it doesn't seem quite right to say that I can't make any meaningful judgments about what it might be like for you to lose your father to cancer. So saying that these comparisons are meaningless may be going too far. But we may want to think why these theorists, and most of them are economists, we may want to think why some of these economists want to insist that interpersonal comparisons are meaningless. And the reasoning seems to be this, that while I can understand what it's like for me to experience a headache or a hangnail or a stubbed toe, I can't really understand what it's like for you to have those experiences, right? And the worry may be something like this, that we all have different thresholds of pain, such that if I experience something very similar to what you experienced, that isn't an indication that I really understand what it's like for you to actually have the same experience. Since psychologically speaking, we're all different in some sense. Right? It may be a very different experience for you to, you know, stub your toe in the middle of the night. Right? Now, I think again that's going a little too far. To say that these such comparisons are meaningless really doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but nevertheless, there are theorists who want to make that claim. So, basically, we're going to ignore those theorists. Right? We're going to ignore the problem of interpersonal comparisons. I think it's possible to make at least some sense of what it means for someone to undergo some experience. Even if we've never experienced that, I think we're pretty good at imagining what it might be like to have such experiences. All right. Let's see. Well, I'm pausing now, and you're probably wondering why. I'm trying to think about how I might describe to you the next part of my lecture. You know, I don't have the advantage of, you know, drawing pictures on the chalkboard. Here, in a case like this, I've got to verbally express everything that I'm supposed to share with you, and that's sometimes hard to do. It's relatively easy to draw a picture and then help you understand a point I'm trying to make. In this case, I don't have that luxury, so I'm just struggling with how to communicate the next example without a picture. All right, so let me put it this way. What I want to do now is to help you see why the welfarist, right, the person who believes that well-being is the only thing that we need to take into account when we're trying to make decisions about, you know, what the good life consists of. And ultimately what that means is look, well-being is the only thing that has intrinsic value. Right? The welfarist believes that. In fact, all other goods, anything that you could possibly imagine, has only instrumental value. Right? And so the welfarist is going to maintain that thesis. And I want to examine or put some pressure on that point of view. I want to ask, you know, just why is it that the welfarist believes that only well-being has intrinsic value? Of course, the answer is going to be something like this. Right? Well, what other things do you care about other than well-being? Right? And when we talk about well-being, as I said earlier, you know, we're talking about happiness. So why does the welfarist claim that happiness is the only thing that has intrinsic value? Well, it seems to be this, right? That we act, in any action that we perform, we act for the sake of happiness, right? I don't do anything in my life that I know will make me unhappy, right? Or at least very seldom I do. Or if I do perform some action that will bring me unhappiness, it's in the hope that in the future it will bring me happiness, right? For example, I understand that by going to the dentist, I'm going to undergo some pain, right, and displeasure, but ultimately it's in the hope that I'll avoid even greater pain in the future, right? So I'm willing to undergo small experiences of pain in order to avoid larger experiences of pain later. Now that's true, but on the whole, right, I want to maximize instances of well-being, right? I want to live well, right? And I live for the sake of happiness. Why do you own a home? Well, I guess I own a home because I want to have some form of security. I want to have a place for my family to live. Well, why do you want those things? Why do you want a family? Why do you care about that? Well, I'm not sure. I never really thought about it. I guess it's because, I value those relationships. My wife makes me a better person, and I care about her, and, I think that I'm better because of her. So why do you care about being better? Well, I guess, I don't know, why do I care about being better? Maybe it's about being happy. I guess it is. It's about being happy, right? It's about having fulfillment in my life. Well, why do you care about being fulfilled in life? Well, ultimately, I think it's about happiness, right? We all want to be happy, and that's the kind of story that the welfarist is going to tell. And other things in our lives, things that we seem to care about, we care about only because they bring about happiness in our lives. All right, so let's think about this possible scenario. I'm thinking of two possible worlds, right? We have world A and we have world B. I'm gonna go very slowly, and you might wanna try to graph this out if you can, just by the way I'm describing it. So we have two possible worlds, world A and world B. And in both of these worlds, we have 1,000 units of well-being, right? So maybe just draw a little circle, two circles, A and B. And then underneath each of those circles, we have 1,000 units of well-being in each. Right? Now, above the circles, you want to draw two sort of graphs, right? And I'm thinking of a bar graph in this case. In the first case, we have 9 people sharing 50 units of well-being, right? And one person with 550 units of well-being. This is world A, right? So in world A, that on the whole has 1,000 units of well-being, what we've got is a situation where 9 people share 50 units each, while one person has the lion's share of well-being, right? 550 units of well-being. And if you add all of that up, it will equal 1,000 units of well-being. In world B, however, what we have is 10 people who share 100 units each. So in world B, what we've got is an equal distribution of well-being. While in world A, we have 9 people sharing 50 units of well-being and one person with 550 units of well-being. Now, if you understand what I'm trying to get at, what I'm trying to communicate is that world B has an equal distribution of well-being, while in world A we have this sort of asymmetrical relation, right, where one person has an overwhelming amount of well-being and the others have only 50 units each. So which world is better, world A or world B? Now, what normally happens when I draw this up on a whiteboard or a chalkboard, students overwhelmingly say that world B is better. And if you understand what I've tried to communicate, you might be thinking the same thing. World B is better because in world B we have an equal distribution of well-being. And that's something we all care about. not something we all care about, we might say, but it's something that enough of us care about that that we think World B is better. The question is, why is World B better? In World A, we have 1,000 units of well-being. In World B, we also have 1,000 units of well-being, but the distribution of well-being is all messed up in World A. Right? You have this asymmetrical relation. In B, we have a very symmetrical distribution of well-being. Everyone has 100 units of well-being. And the key here is that well-being is distributed equally. Right? So what is it that we care about in this case? We care about equality. That's what we care about, equality. We care about well-being, but we also care about equality. What we want is for, we want to encourage an equal distribution of well-being. So that's what's driving a lot of people to think that World B is better. The interesting question is to ask, what will the welfarist suggest is the best of both worlds, of the two worlds? And the welfarist is going to say that neither world is preferable to the other. Why is that? The answer is that both worlds have 1,000 units of well-being, right? And that's why, right? Both worlds have 1,000 units of well-being, and the welfarist is going to say, it really doesn't matter how you distribute the well-being. As long as both worlds have 1,000 units of well-being, they're equally good, right? Distribution has nothing to do with it. And why is that? Well, it's because there's really no correlation between, at least no one-to-one correlation between resources and happiness. Now, most of us, when we're presented with this example, when we start thinking about which world is better, World A or World B, we find ourselves thinking about resources, right? Such that the person with the most resources is the happiest. But is that really the case? That's what we want to find out. Now, there's something in economic theory called the diminishing margin of return. The diminishing margin of return shows that there really is no correlation, no strong correlation between the amount of things in my life, right, the resources that I have at my disposal, and the amount of satisfaction or the amount of happiness that I derive from those objects, from those resources. One way to think about this is to think of it this way. Imagine that you have no money at all, $0, and I have $1,000,000. Now, imagine also that I give you $500, which reduces my, you know, my my spending, what do I want to say here? Purchasing power, right? It reduces my purchasing power to $999,500. Right? Now you have $500 and I have $999.5. Right? Who is that $500 more valuable to? Is it more valuable to you or is it more valuable to me? Seems like it's far more valuable to you. Right? You move from nothing to $500, while I move from $1,000,000 to $999.5. I still have tremendous purchasing power and you've moved from zero to $500. Imagine I give you an additional a total of $1,000, right? Still, the $1,000 is still worth way more to you than it is to me. Now I'm at $999, and you're at $1,000. Right? The money is far more valuable to you than it is to me. And this is ultimately what the diminishing margin of return shows. Right? It shows that there is no reliable correlation between the things that we have in our lives and the amount of satisfaction that we derive from those things that we have in our lives. Another way to think about this is to think about visiting Taco Bell. Right? Imagine that Taco Bell is having a sale on, or some kind of special on tacos. You can get 10 tacos for $1. So you go over to Taco Bell and you eat your taco or your tacos. The amount of satisfaction that you derive from the first taco will be far greater than the satisfaction that you derive from the 10th. Right? In fact, what will happen is the satisfaction you derive from each taco will continue to diminish over time. Right? The first taco will be fairly satisfying. The second taco a little bit less satisfying. The third taco, even less satisfying. The fourth, even less, right? And the satisfaction that you derive from these experiences will continue to diminish. And this is true for any commodity that you can possibly imagine, right? Seems to be the case. And here's the deal. We could say it of money, right? For every dollar that I obtain, each additional dollar is worth less to me, right? Now let me say that again. For every dollar I obtain, each additional dollar will be worth less to me, right? That's the idea. And we could say this of tacos too. For every taco that I consume, each additional taco will be less satisfying, right? So that's the diminishing margin of return. Why are we talking about the diminishing margin of return? Well, the welfarist wants to use the diminishing margin of return to show us that there is no reliable correlation between resources and happiness. Right? So, what we want to say is that even though in world B there is an equal distribution of well-being, right? There is no way to really do that in the real world. Right? What are we saying? Well, we're saying this. Even if we were to distribute resources equally, right? If I had $100 to give to every student listening to this lecture, I give you all $100, there's no guarantee that you will derive the same amount of satisfaction from that $100. Even though we've distributed our resources equally, there is no correlation between the amount of happiness that you'll derive from that $100, right? Some of you will be far happier with the $100 than others, right? And that's what welfarists want to show, is that there really is no correlation between distributing resources, which we could do in principle, distribute resources equally, but even that would not guarantee that everyone would be equally happy. Right? All right. Now, what's the point of that? Well, the point is that equality is only instrumentally valuable. Right? We care about equality to the extent that it brings us happiness. We care about equality because we value happiness, not because we value equality itself. Right? And remember, welfarists are trying to make the case that equality is only instrumentally valuable and not intrinsically valuable, right? The only thing that has intrinsic value for the welfarist is well-being. Okay, let's see. I've been talking for, looks like, almost 38 minutes. I want to do some more of this. I think I'll end here. But when we return, or when I return, I'll talk about two other things that we might consider as having intrinsic value, that the welfarist will continue to resist the move to regard other things that we might normally think of as having intrinsic value. Do you remember the distinction between instrumental and intrinsic value? That's what, one of the things you'll want to return to. Right? Something that has intrinsic value acquires its value from itself. Right? It doesn't appeal to anything else for its value. While things that are instrumentally valuable always appeal to their ability to promote some other good, right? In this sense, an aspirin, for example, is instrumentally valuable because it helps me to achieve some other state, right? In this case, to avoid pain and to feel better about my situation. Okay, so that's the distinction. Intrinsic goods are good all on their own, right? They derive their value from themselves, while instrumental goods derive their value from their ability to bring about some other recognized good. All right, so we'll end here, and when I return the next time we come together, we'll talk about two other things that people have often thought are intrinsically valuable, but the welfarist continues to insist that these things also have only instrumental value. Okay, see you next time.